The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
Hi, this is the Takeaway Podcast for Monday, August 8th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Another police shooting crisis for the city of Chicago. Protests this weekend quietly registered outrage over the shooting death of 18-year-old Paul O'Neill, who was black, fatally shot in the back. Week-old video of the aftermath of the shooting was released on Friday. There was an alleged stolen car in the incident. The video shows officers running through a backyard and handcuffing O'Neill as he lay on the ground, soaked in blood. The footage captured one of the officers saying,
"They shot at us too, right?"
It was later revealed that O'Neill was unarmed. For a community on edge, this is a test for everyone, from newly installed Chicago Police Department Superintendent Eddie Johnson on down. And is there much trust to build on here? Lori Lightfoot is a partner at the law firm Mayor Brown and president of the Chicago Police Board, an independent civilian oversight group. Lori, welcome back to The Takeaway.
It's my pleasure, John.
So what is the chief concern right now for the community of Chicago? And I guess the question of justice for Paul O'Neill is moot at this point.
Well, I don't think the question is moot, but I think the shooting of Mr. O'Neill underscores a lot of, I think, challenges that remain in Chicago. First and foremost, the continued strained relationships between the community and the police, what's going on in the police department regarding accountability, and the larger question of how do we move forward as a community and heal the rift so that people feel like they're safe in their neighborhoods and that the police department is viewed with legitimacy. Now, I think the superintendent of police took some, I think, important steps immediately in the aftermath of the shooting. He and his team huddled together, reviewed the videotape, and then immediately stripped two officers of their law enforcement privileges, and then a third a few days thereafter. The videotapes were released within 8 days of the shooting, which is record time here in Chicago, and really is consistent with the recommendation of the Police Accountability Task Force, which I chaired, to get these videos, audios, and police reports out as quickly as possible.
What's the test of the new leadership at the Chicago Police Department?
Well, I think they're tested every single day, and the work of healing the rift between the police and the community is something that is going to be slow but has to be steady and committed work. The tension that we see now wasn't over one incident or even a series of incidents, but really was built up over decades. And I think that they also have to demonstrate, and it's walking a bit of a fine line, is not only that they're willing to engage the community, which is absolutely critical, but that they're willing to demonstrate that when an officer does the wrong thing, they're going to step up and they're going to own that and take responsibility for it. But by the same token, they have got to get officers better training, better support, so that when they have to make those snap judgments, they're doing it with a base of knowledge, a base of experience that's going to lead them to the right conclusion.
I guess I don't understand what would have caused the officers here to have done something that clearly, you know, crossed a line that right now in this community is such a divisive and source of instability.
Well, you know, officers in incidents have to make snap judgments. And the only way they're going to make good decisions when they make those snap judgments is if they have the proper training and skills and, frankly, supervision. But fundamentally, officers are going to be in those situations every single day. And the only way they're going to make good decisions is if they've gotten excellent training, that training is refreshed, and they've gotten good supervision to really work through this could happen. And if this happens, what's your response? And if it's not the right response, to lead them to a different place through better, more reinforced training.
Why would there ever be an appropriate shooting of someone in the back, though?
look, I'm not going to stand here in judgment of the shooting. And I think there's a number of investigations going on. And I think in fairness to those investigations, we have to let them play out. But it obviously looks terrible. It looks terrible that this person now out of the vehicle, running away, and then ends up getting shot in the back. But we need to know a lot more facts before we can cast any judgment on those circumstances. But here again, given that the department has so little goodwill that it can draw upon, it puts them many, many steps back.
How would you characterize the demonstrations that have taken place since this incident, thinking in terms of making a statement as opposed to spreading a kind of civic chaos in the city?
Well, I have to say I've been very proud of the protests that have followed this incident. We had one that was organized by a couple of teenage girls, and they simply did a sit-in at one of the major parks here in the city. I think those teenagers were involved in a march that happened yesterday. We had some intense moments in our city, particularly following the release of the Laquan McDonald video last November. But I have to say I'm very proud of the people here, because even though some of those instances have been very tense and at times they felt like they could potentially erupt into violence, that hasn't happened. We haven't seen in Chicago the scenes that we've seen across the country and other cities where things have completely devolved into chaos. There's been theft. There's been arson. There's been a lot of assaults on people. There's been robberies of stores. We have not seen that in Chicago. In all of this, regardless of the perspective that one brings to these very important but also complicated and difficult issues, all of us need to be working towards solutions. And I think the young kids that are leading these efforts, they get that. They actually get that and, frankly, can be and will be an example for the adults.
Lori Lightfoot, it's always great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Lori Lightfoot is a partner at the law firm Mayor Brown and president of the Chicago Police Board, an independent civilian oversight group. On the other side of the world, what is the role of Turkey right now in the unstable Middle East? Should Turkey's allies back away from a president who has purged more than 60,000 people, including police officers, teachers, judges, and journalists? They've been removed or suspended from their jobs in the months since the reported coup. President Erdogan's regime has justified the purges by accusing these individuals of being collaborators and part of a secret network of anti-government Islamists led by Fethullah Gulen, a self-exiled Muslim cleric and former political rival of Erdogan's living in the United States. A petition by Turkey to extradite Gulen is expected to be denied by U.S. officials. As Erdogan's power becomes more concentrated due to the purges, how are Turkey's allies to see their role in supporting or criticizing this important player in the region? People living in Turkey right now just want stability and seem inclined to believe the conspiratorial theories of President Erdogan for now. Mina Adair is a professor at Bogazici University, argues that the U.S. and the EU should soften their criticism of the nature of Erdogan's regime. More than anything, Turkey needs support right now.
The focus is very much on rebuilding the state, really, because we have found out that our state is no longer functioning because it's been somewhat occupied by people who have absolutely different kinds of loyalties and people who are gathering intelligence and, having judges, professors. You know, so it's very scary what we're going through in terms of finding out how deep this network of what seemingly is a very innocent looking, you know, sort of social movement, civil society movement, lookalike religious society has now systematically taken over some of the institutions of the state.
How does it concern you that the net effect of all these purges and the removal mm-hmm. of 60,000 people from the civil authorities, civil right. jobs all throughout the country is going to give Erdogan an autocratic-like power over the government that he describes as democratic?
He does have authoritarian tendencies, and it's been a major problem. But nevertheless, we know these people for 14 years, right? What we were talking about on the 15th of July are people whom we don't know, have never heard of, having some sort of a secret society and taking over the state. That's, to me, it's the lesser of two evils. Now, what we have to do as people in the opposition, we have an enormous responsibility here as well, that it's, that doesn't turn into a witch hunt, that it doesn't turn into this kind of sort of bundling people together as Gulenists, and really making sure that we differentiate the ones who are criminal and who really took part into this kind of a, you know, process of tanks and F-16s bombing the innocent people. But as we find out more about this particular secret society, it's very clear that this is not a sort of simply, a moderate Islamist, cultural, lots of schools, universities opened around the world kind of a movement. It's got that angle to it, yes, but ultimately the core group apparently on the top really had a systematic vision of taking over the state. Now, having said that, you know, this purging of all the people who for whom there is evidence for loyalty to the Gulen movement, now this is a big problem, and that's what I meant by state building. How are we going to make sure that people are now appointed to their positions based on merit? Because it turns out that this particular movement also faked entrance exams and, organized for their own students so that they could go into the military schools, that they could go into the best universities. I mean, we're really faced with a grand scale corruption.
So should the U.S. turn over Gulen to...
No, frankly, I think he should be extradited and be judged fairly and squarely according to the rule of law in Turkey, and to see whether these charges and this evidence against them is actually true. But obviously, if Turkey passes that sort of, you know, death penalty or goes into that direction, it will be impossible for that to happen. It should all stay within the rule of law.
As that process proceeds, as you're saying,
right.
And
mm-hmm.
that Erdogan wants to restore something of a secular democracy based on merit, what should the role of Turkey's allies be, who have been really shaken by everything that's happened?
Help us build institutions. Help us build institutions and judges that know independence of separation of powers. Help us build, get engaged with universities, academics, who, by the way, are no fan of Tayyip Erdogan. But this is not the time. I mean, our democracy is now being under attack for an entirely different mechanism. Now, we'll have to get rid of Erdogan through the ballot box, through elections and through mobilization against him, but not this way, not through the tanks and the helicopters. And I think we need the empathy, engagement, and really solidarity from the international community to make sure that Turkey stays a vibrant democratic society.
Mina Adair, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mina Adair is a professor at Boğaziçi University in Istanbul. Refugees continue to pour into Europe. According to the Pew Research Center, between July 2015 and May 2016, over a million people sought European asylum from war-torn countries like Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Despite widespread resistance in some countries, Germany has taken in over 300,000 refugees, while more than 100,000 have been resettled in Sweden. Austria is a nation of just 8.5 million people and has welcomed 90,000 immigrants last year and 37,500 this year. Michael Giggle is director of the Austrian Tourist Office in New York, and he joins me now. These are amazing numbers for Austria, a small country accepting so many refugees. Apparently, the percentage of immigrants in Austria right now is 18%.
Yeah, Austria has a long tradition historically as a multi-ethnic nation. So in that sense, it's no surprise. And I guess our geographic location just, put us in a certain situation that we're trying to do our best in.
What accounts for the lack of political outrage and concern over these influxes of refugees?
Well, I would say, like any country that's facing a situation like this, there is challenge, and there are political challenges and there are logistical challenges. But I think the situation actually in Austria is rather normal. If travelers go there right now, they probably wouldn't even notice anything different than they would have, noticed a couple of years ago. There are obviously some changes the way we travel across borders within Europe nowadays. Schengen agreement sort of being not halted per se, but border checks have been reintroduced within certain parts of Europe just to make sure the situation is handled well. But other than that, it's a very, you know, pleasant situation in most ways. And I think travelers that, you know, either come from Austria and travel some places, or travelers, let's say, from the United States traveling to Austria, would for the most part not even notice any changes.
Has travel been different for Austrians? Are they staying put this summer? Are they not traveling as much as they might have in the past?
Austrians love to travel. What we have seen, a slight uptick in Austrians that stay within the country. That's historically been a strong factor for Austria. You know, people living in Vienna want to go out to the mountains. They want to go out to the beautiful lakes and enjoy the countryside. We have seen an increase of about 4% of the Austrians in the summer season now staying within the country. But that is not a number that is extremely unusual. We've also seen an uptick still for the first half of this year for another 3% from the United States.
Where have immigrants been settling? Has it been in urban centers? Has it been in particular enclaves?
Mostly we're talking people that are seeking asylum. So they are being processed, being settled, first of all, throughout the process of their asylum application. And it's really happening throughout the country, both in big cities, but also in small communities. They are really, in essence, being spread around the country. So in order to lessen the impact of any one individual community and allow for, you know, the best possible integration once the asylum process has been handled.
Is there more of a sense of an Arabic community inside Austria that you would notice?
I think visually, when you travel Vienna, you travel on the subway, you may notice visually a little bit more, yes. But as I said, as a country that's always had a very strong multi-ethnic population, it's not something that I would find highly unusual, no.
But falafel and hummus are more available now than before.
Yeah, but I would still try the Wiener Schnitzel first.
Which I see very devoted to national cuisine. Is there an economic issue with assimilating these refugees that is seen as a burden borne by the Austrian economy?
Yeah, there are challenges, clearly. I mean, when you have to integrate people in a country, sets of rules have to be followed and certain work permit issues and those kind of things. It's not an easy process per se. It's not my area of expertise per se, and I think the country is handling it quite well from what we can see, living here, but also traveling back to Austria several times a year. The number you mentioned earlier, 90,000 asylum seekers that we accepted last year, if you would relate that to the American population, that would be something like 3 million asylum seekers in the United States. So that's a pretty solid number that you have to deal with in a humane and smart way.
Why not the rise of nationalist political tendencies in Austria, as there have been in Germany and Denmark and in France particularly?
I think in general, you know, my take, and I think to a very large extent, that's hopefully true. I think we have learned from our own history. I think many, many thousands of Austrians were extremely helpful last year when the situation was much less organized than it is this year. This year, really, it's not the sort of situation where we were overwhelmed on certain days, really, on the borders. This doesn't seem to be the case this year. It's much more organized, and a lot of it has to do with the agreement that the EU has struck with Turkey and just the sheer number of refugees coming across on a daily basis is much, much smaller than it was last year.
Michael Giegel is director for the Austrian Tourist Office right here in New York City. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Swimming in the water, swimming in the river, swimming in the sea.
Chlorine, Michael Phelps, and the American flag. Every 4 years, swimming seems like the American national pastime. Michael Phelps won his 19th gold medal last night, and Katie Ledecky crushed her own record in the 400 freestyle. American swimmers have dominated the podium at the Olympics, winning nearly three times as many medals as their closest competitor, Australia. This is curious for Americans who largely don't go near the water. 54% of Americans can't pass a simple swim test, according to the Red Cross, and the Centers for Disease Control warns that 10 people die from unintentional drowning every day in America. Terry Lachlan is a swim coach who developed the total immersion method of swim instruction. He's been coaching for more than 40 years. He's coached 24 national champions, both USA Swimming and NCAA, including two Olympic medalists. Welcome to The Takeaway, Terry.
Thank you, John.
So this isn't very much of an American pastime, yet you know, the Michael Phelpses of the world are you know, dominating.
Well, competitive swimming is a bubble, I lived in that bubble for quite a few years. I started swimming competitively myself in 1965 and then continued as a coach from 1972 through 1988. And it wasn't until I stopped being a swimming coach that I realized that I had been living in a bubble where everyone started swimming at 4 or 5, and the people who carried on to become competitive swimmers always learned faster and swam better than their peers. And that's even more true if you're good enough to swim in the Olympics.
So what explains the hesitance on the part of Americans to go in the water?
Well, it's their experiences. I would say it's a fair statement that for most people, their first attempt to swim a lap is a near-death experience. outside that bubble that I spoke of, virtually everyone experiences incredible struggle just to learn even the most basic skills and often outright defeat. And, you know, you said that only 54%, what was the statistic? 54% had basic skills or something like that?
Can't pass a swimming test by the Red Cross. Can
pass a swimming
test.
Yeah, only 30% can swim the length of a 25-meter pool. And the American Swimming Coaches Association and the National Swim School Association have estimated that only 2% can swim a quarter mile nonstop, which is kind of the fundamental level of swimming in order to swim for fitness. And it's that distance that Katie Ledecky took 3 minutes and 56 seconds to swim last night. So it is extremely rare. Now, why? And I didn't discover this until I started total immersion and began working with what I call adult onset swimmers, people who only began swimming in midlife. And once I started working with them, I realized that virtually everyone I was working with was extremely anxious, that they were really uncomfortable in the water, and they responded to that anxiety with a lot of struggle. So they weren't really swimming. They were struggling.
And would you say that, you know, it's beyond simply hesitance that people are afraid of the water in America? Well, there's a culture of fear.
It's part of our basic primal survival instinct. You know, swimming is an aquatic skill, and we are terrestrial mammals, and we swim like it. If you think about what's in common, dogs, deer, and humans, we swim with the head up to avoid choking, and all our limbs going like crazy to avoid sinking. So it's all about avoidance, not about swimming with grace or ease or, God forbid, joy.
So all mammals are hesitant about swimming, and we're no different. But
We're very respectful of the water. You know, that there's been a fair bit said about running being a primal activity, and I would say swimming is just the absolute antithesis of that, or at least swimming well.
Well, you know, I've been to Australia. Are Australians a form of fish then? Because it seems like everybody swims in Australia.
I think the thing is that, and I've visited Australia a number of times, and I obviously I go to pools, and every pool has a teaching pool right next to it, and we don't see that here very often. So there's I think more of an emphasis on teaching, but I'm not sure they teach any better than we do. They just make better use of a smaller population, I suppose. But the form of teaching that's done here, the American Red Cross method, is, or the Amateur Swimming Association in England, or the ABC in Holland, everybody is teaching, basically trying to improve terrestrial technique. And so it focuses on the pull and the kick. I mean, anyone who's taken basic swimming lessons know that one of the first things they do is have you practice your kick, and they work on the pull. But propulsion or pulling and kicking is not the fundamental skill. It's dealing with that fear of choking and sinking.
So would you say that better swimming instruction is an imperative for preventing unintentional drowning or for getting people just largely more involved in the sport of swimming itself?
Yeah, a different way of teaching. You know, the critical first step is not to hand somebody a kickboard and have them strengthen their legs so they don't sink. It's recognizing that physics is the reason that the human body sinks, not weak legs. We have an upper body that's has a six, you know, a bladder that holds 6 liters of air. So buoyancy is pushing up on the upper body, and gravity is pulling down on our much denser lower body. And it's not really a threat to our well-being, but our brain, our reptilian or primal brain, interprets that as a real threat to our survival. And so we respond with, you know, what I said before, churning the arms and legs. And you have to calm that. You have to let people experience weightlessness. So it's really about gliding. It's about releasing the head's weight to the water, because only 5% of the human body, we are heavier than water. And only 5% of the body mass of a human will be above the surface. But the head itself is 8%. So when you hold the head up, because of that primal fear, everything else will start sinking. And you feel that, you feel threatened, and you start turning.
Veteran swimming coach Terry Laughlin developed the total immersion method of swimming instruction. Thanks so much, Terry.
Thank you, John. My pleasure.
Do computers yearn deep down to have their poetry published in literary journals? These are among the mysteries of a project curated by computational biologist Carmel Allison, the only human on staff at her literary magazine called Curated AI. That AI stands for artificial intelligence. Allison's poets are machines that write original works based on what they've learned about the habits and styles of other human writers. High-tech plagiarism? Or is this stuff any good? More important, can readers tell the difference?
There's quite a bit of range. There's the, you know, completely quoting things that exist on the internet, but in a new format. And on the other side, trying to write to machines that actually write literature, having learned something about language. There's a specific type of machine learning model that can be trained on any different, you know, different sets of literature, different sets of poetry, and can from there generate new sentences or new statements using this set of words and this set of learned information.
I am dead. For I was not a woman to keep the man in. My own love, I could be your life. The light falls on her hands, with the light from a mother's eye, from a glance.
That's from C-Word by a computer, Deep Gimbal. It is kind of amazing. I can't tell if it's telling me something about the computer or telling me something about my brain.
Right, right. Well, it's, you know, I guess from the postmodern perspective, literature and poetry is all about interpretation anyways, right? We should never be asking what the author's intent is. And this is the sort of the extreme version of that, where the author in this case is a machine and doesn't necessarily have intent. Any meaning that we read into this is coming from us, from you. And that gives it it makes you much more aware of what we're doing when we're reading literature and when we're reading poems like this.
Computer by a roadside in the river where you go back into houses of sand as I do in a valley of wood with my garden. I am a small man who is the first, the same of your body. I really like that. That scares me that I really like that. I really like that, though. That's great.
Yeah, right. So that's, you know, it evokes something, you know, it evokes emotion, even though the thing creating it has necessarily no emotion in creating it.
What example is something that really just sort of took your breath away?
There was one machine that has published a piece of prose. The machine was called Tolstoyish, and it was trained on some group of works from Leo Tolstoy.
The children cried with the sound of their hoofs. The inspector and his hostess.
It sounds shockingly like Tolstoy.
The whole business is not the case, he added to the officer. And his face expressed that he was very much interested.
It doesn't really make sense in a certain way.
But the chief cause of this interview had come into a new life. He had to find a certain possible right.
But still, it sounds a lot like Tolstoy. That to me was really neat, and that was, a nice proof of concept that we as human beings have personality and that Tolstoy has a unique sound that is different from others, but also that we can begin to imitate and regenerate that using machine learning. Like, well, you can, in theory, have a conversation between, a Tolstoy machine and, another author of your choice. And where could we go with that? Interesting things to explore from a literary perspective using machines as proxies.
Well, there's a radio show, Edgar Allan Poe and Charles Dickens. Is this reassuring that you've done this, or is this just terrifying?
To me, it's reassuring because the joy of it is the human aspect, right? And so to me, it speaks of the collaborative nature of human and machine learning. I'm not worried that a machine will take my theoretical job as a poet. I don't get paid to be a poet. But if I did, I wouldn't be worried that a machine would take my job yet, because, it's empty without the human element.
What's the mission for the software designers who are working on this kind of AI to have some level of interaction, it's got to go beyond learning somehow?
I think it varies, obviously. I think for a lot of people, the goal is to, this is a toy problem in a sense, but if you can train a machine to write poetry or write literature, that's very similar to training a machine that can interact with a human being, right? That can understand language well enough that it can ask and answer questions and that it can be informative. There are definitely applications that go beyond, well, this is fun and it's literature. And, I think those, somewhere in that spectrum is what's driving a lot of different authors.
That's just amazing. Has the computer spit out anything that seemed almost plagiarism?
Yes, there's a sense that, nothing is new under the sun, right? This I was playing with this actually at the same time that the whole Melania Trump scandal was going down. And it's like, well, there are only so many ways to form a platitude, right? So what can you do? Authors have similar ways of constructing things because we read things in a certain way and we like to hear things in a certain way, and there's familiarity that is part of what grabs us. One of the lines you read, the sun shines bright on her lips, that may exist in poetry somewhere. It's familiar enough, and it could have been written by a human being.
Well, the high bar here, it seems, is that you submit one or two of your poems to the New Yorker.
Right. Yeah. So I've submitted poems that I've written in the past to the New Yorker and never gotten in. So my secret goal is eventually I'll get one of these published in the New Yorker without them knowing. And then that is, we've passed the Turing test, at least for poetry, right?
You're very devilish. Not a speck of morality in her at all, but that's great. Well, Carmel Allison, fascinating project, and thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Carmel Allison is founder and editor-in-chief of CuratedAI.com. And here's something to take with you today.
The 2-0. Ichiro to right and deep. Back goes Parra to the wall, and it's off the wall! 3,000 is in right field, and Ichiro is racing for third!
The Olympics aren't the only place to make history for athletes this week. Miami Marlin outfielder Ichiro Suzuki became the 30th member of Major League Baseball's 3,000-hit club, and you heard it there on FSFL-TV. The first member from Japan, so here's how it sounded in his home country on Japanese TV. At 42, Ichiro has sustained excellence from his early days in Japan to today. Perhaps we shouldn't be surprised. The man who holds the MLB record for the most hits by a rookie has kept up his winning streak throughout his career. Ichiro has been a pioneer for Japanese players. Before he came to the U.S., the only Japanese players considered good enough to excel in the major leagues were pitchers, and now Ichiro's famous bat, made out of Japanese tamo wood, has hit that idea out of the park. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org. The Takeaway is on Anchor. If you have the Anchor app and search The Takeaway, it's a great way to reply to one of our questions or chats. And if you're starting a discussion that you'd like us to hear, use the tag The Takeaway. Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. You can also check out the latest John Hockenberry blog post and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.
Public Radio International.